really think it's kind of the heart of the book. It really is, in many respects, if you're going to get the book of Daniel, you have to get chapter 7. And there's so much here in order to understand the rest of the book. So I want to make sure that everybody's clear on chapter 7 before we go into the other prophecies. So we'll probably be in chapter 7 for at least 3 weeks. And by the way, we're not going to finish Daniel in the spring. I mean, it'll be next fall at least, which is good. This is actually, if you understand the book of Daniel, I don't want to sound arrogant, but if you understand the book of Daniel, you will never be an amillennialist. It's the honest truth. But at any rate, it is a profound book. Let me first of all observe from stepping back and just I gave you a timeline here at the top, and this is kind of, I gave this to you last time. This I did on Excel, and this is a kind of a slightly simplified version from the last one and slightly corrected. But at any rate, you can see there Daniel in captivity from 605 to 536 BC. That's roughly, now that's not the age of Daniel, that's how long he was in captivity. He was in captivity from 605, that's when Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem the first time. That was the first year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and he was in Babylon till at least 536 BC. We're not exactly sure which year he died for sure, but it was at least a year, a couple years after Cyrus became king, and the Medo-Persian Empire took over, and that was in 539 when Babylon fell. So we know he was there at least till 536. So how old he was? He had to be in his 80s. We don't know exactly how old he was when he died. But at any rate, that kind of gives you a. Now you can look down through. I have there in the green. That is the Neo-Babylonian kingdom. The Neo-Babylonian kingdom began with Nabopolassar, who's not actually on the chart, but the main king was Nebuchadnezzar, his son, and he's the one that destroyed the temple at Jerusalem. He's the one that came to Jerusalem three different times and took captives each time. The first one was in 605. That was when Daniel was taken. In 597, it was when Ezekiel was taken and Jehoiakim. In 586, Jerusalem was destroyed. Those are the three times Nebuchadnezzar came to Jerusalem. And it's interesting, this is just an aside, I'm not sure why, but the book of Daniel does not mention the destruction of Jerusalem, or the destruction of the temple. It actually speaks about the second destruction of the temple and implies the third temple, but it never actually speaks about, I don't think, it actually mentions the destruction of the temple in 586, even though it happened while he was there in Babylon. And then you can see after Nebuchadnezzar, this is this green section there in the chart, there were three kings successively over a period of 6 years, and then Nabonidus, who was actually probably, we're not 100% sure, what was probably the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. We think he married his daughter, Nabonidus, and Belshazzar was his son, and Belshazzar was a co-regent from 553 to the end, 539. And then Cyrus took over. And you can see there in the blue, below the green, I have the book of Daniel, and those numbers are the chapters of the book of Daniel. And that's to kind of help you to see where the book falls in regard to the reigns of the kings. So you can see chapters 1 and 2 were at the very beginning. Chapter 3, we're not sure exactly what year it was, but based on what we know about Nebuchadnezzar, we think it was roughly somewhere around, it was after the fall of Jerusalem, sometime in the 570s or something. But at any rate, and then chapter 4 was near the end of his reign. That's when he had the vision. Nebuchadnezzar had the vision and was humbled. And then chapter 7 or chapter 5 happens at the end of Belshazzar's reign and the very end of the empire or the Babylonian empire. And then 7, 8, 9 through 12, all of those are the visions that Daniel had, and you can see they were all towards the end. So that's just kind of an overview of historically the time period that Daniel covers and the kings and so forth. This is significant because this is the time when Babylon took over the whole area and destroyed Jerusalem, and they went into captivity into Babylon. And Daniel was among those first to go into captivity. And why were they in captivity? Yeah, exactly. To fulfill Deuteronomy 28. In other words, it was because of their refusal to obey the commandments and keep God's law. In fact, we're told very specifically that the reason they were there for 70 years is because they disobeyed the Sabbath year command, and that was how long he let the land rest. 1 year for every year they didn't honor the Sabbath year. So for 490 years, 7 times 70, okay, they had not honored the Sabbath year, and that's why they were there for 70 years, which becomes significant in chapter 9. But at any rate, that's where we are, and that's kind of the context of the book of Daniel. He is in captivity, and of course, you know the story of Daniel and how he was taken as a youth, probably a teenager, and was trained by the Babylonians for 3 years, and actually ended up becoming a main advisor to the king. The theme of Daniel, in a broad way, is really the sovereignty of God over the history of the world. Now that's not unique to Daniel. That, in a sense, is in many respects is one of the major themes in the whole of the Old Testament. And really the whole of the Bible, that God is sovereign over not just the nation of Israel, not just the people of God, but he's actually sovereign over all the kings of the earth. He's sovereign over everything that happens in the world. He is sovereign over especially the kingdoms of this world. So if you look at Daniel chapter 4, verse 34 through 37, this is just an example. And this is Nebuchadnezzar's testimony after his changed heart, and this really becomes the theme of the book in many respects. This is a significant because it's the testimony of the head of gold. This is the testimony of the king of Babylon, who is the head of gold in the image in chapter 2. He says, "At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and my understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High. And I praised and honored him that lives forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation." Here's the king of kings, if you will, the great king Babylon, acknowledging that there's one infinitely above him who's eternal, the king of kings, who is the Lord, who's everlasting, and his dominion is everlasting. Verse 35, "And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he does according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, What doest thou?" This is Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, that's a pretty amazing statement for this king to make, that the Lord is not just Lord on earth, he's Lord in heaven, and nobody is able to ask him, "What are you doing?" Isn't that man's problem? Man's problem so often is he wants to demand of God, "What are you doing?" You know, we don't have that right. We do not have the right to ask God, "What are you doing?" He knows what he's doing. Okay? And he's perfect in his ways, but his ways are in the sea, as it says, right? And then verse 36, "At the same time, my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and brightness returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom. An excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase." Now that's, I mean, that really, that almost summarizes what the theme of the book is. that he is able, A, he's sovereign over all things, he's sovereign over the kings of the earth, he's sovereign over everything, but also, notice, he is able to abase those who are in pride. And so, major theme, that's the major theme of the book of Daniel, but there's a very second important theme which is closely related and intertwined with it, maybe a sub-theme. And that is the whole issue of the coming, and this is especially true in chapter 7, the whole issue of the coming of this eternal kingdom. That, you know, there's a sense in which God has been reigning over the universe from day one. He's king of the universe. But the kingdom of heaven coming to earth, where he will destroy the kingdoms of this world and will restore this world to its glory and perfection. The coming of that kingdom is a major theme. Now, I just want to reiterate, as you look at the Old Testament, as you read the Old Testament, what is developed from the beginning, as you know from Genesis 3:15, that there will be the one who will come from the seed of the woman, the seed of the woman who will, in fact, undo the work of Satan and restore the world to its perfection. And when he gave that prophecy, it was actually to Satan, but when he gave that prophecy, you know, at that point, they had no idea how bad the world would get. They had no idea how much immorality, how much wickedness, how much war, how much death, how much sickness, how much pain, how much confusion. Adam and Eve had no idea what they just opened up. Before all that came, God said, I'm going to send someone who's going to undo it. And it would be a man, it come from the woman. And implied almost seems to be the virgin birth, right? Well, from that point, all the faithful are looking eschatologically to this future individual. This one who we come to know as the Messiah, who would become this, you know, we knew he was from the seed of Abraham eventually. Then we come to know he's going to be the son of David. He's going to be the king. He's going to be a priest. And he's going to be a prophet. He's going to be all three. And but what goes along with that, as these prophecies develop through the Old Testament, is that this king will have a kingdom. And this kingdom, who are the people of the kingdom in the Old Testament? The Jews. It's all based on the promises that God made to the Jews through Abraham. The promises he made to Abraham are the foundation of all their hope. That God said he would give them this land, he defined this land, and he told them that they will be in this land. And then he gave them this covenant that said, if you obey me, you'll be in the land. But then he gave them a prophecy and said, well, you won't obey the covenant and you're going to be thrown out of the land. But at the very end, I'm going to bring you back to the land and I'm going to give you a new heart and you're going to be blessed in the land. And that became known as the kingdom promises, that he was going to eventually save all of the Jewish people and bring them back to the land and regenerate them. And that from them, the Messiah would rule not only over the Jewish people in the land, but over the whole world. That's the concept of the kingdom that you see constantly through the Old Testament. And it is developed gradually and incredibly, in an incredibly detailed way. And by the time you get to the prophets, which are later in the Old Testament, obviously, this idea of the kingdom is developed to an immense, it's like a tree of prophecy, of description of all that the kingdom will be like. And it's, you know, you read the book of Isaiah and read the minor prophets and Ezekiel and Jeremiah, and they speak about this kingdom. Now, why did I say that? When you come to Daniel, what is unique about the book of Daniel to all the prophecies in the Old Testament is that it actually describes in great detail the question of the timing of the kingdom, when the kingdom will come. And that's one of the unique things about the book of Daniel. It actually deals with the question of time. And that's what's profound, and that's especially true in the second half of the book. But I want you to look at chapter 7, verse 9 through 14, because I think in some ways, I would say this is the heart of the book. This is a description of the day when the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. It's when Psalm 2:6 is fulfilled, when God said, I will set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. And that's what it's referring to in chapter 7 through 9 through 14. This is that day. He says, behold, I beheld till the thrones were cast down and the Ancient of Days did sit. That's God the Father. His garment was white as snow and the hair of his head like the pure wool. His throne was like a fiery flame and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. I beheld then, because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke, that's the Antichrist, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed, and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night vision, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. This is obviously Christ. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nation, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Now, if you're an amillennialist, that's already in the past. I'm not an amillennialist. Okay, that's still future. Okay, I want to be clear. This is the center of the book. And if you will understand this book, one of the glories of this book is it describes in great detail the history that's still future in terms of what things will be like when this day takes place. There's so much in, especially the second half of the book, about the very nature of the time when this happens. And if you understand the book well, you have to understand chapter 7 well. So that's why, this is why I wanted to emphasize chapter 7. You can see there, just real quickly, the outline of Daniel. It divides very neatly. There are two ways to divide it. I think this is the most logical way. Personally, that is chapters 1 through 6 is basically history, and it basically is the history of Daniel. And you can see there chapter 1. I mean, you know these chapters because they're such, you know, everybody knows the first half of Daniel so well because of the narrative. There is his captivity and training in chapter 1. Chapter 2 is Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the great image. And through that vision, Daniel then becomes second in the kingdom, basically. And then in chapter 3, the fiery furnace, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are delivered from the fiery furnace. Nebuchadnezzar's vision of the great tree is in chapter 4 when he's humbled. And then in chapter 5, it's the handwriting on the wall when Belshazzar is having his party and using the utensils and so forth from the temple for his party. Seems to be an intentional blasphemy, like, you know, we're against the God of Israel. And God brings Belshazzar's party to an abrupt close with a handwriting on the wall, and his life ends at night. And then chapter 6, the lion's den. Now, in chapter 7 through 12, then, you have visions. These are the visions of Daniel. And you have in chapter 7, the vision of the four beasts. In chapter 8, the vision of the ram and the goat. In chapter 9, the vision of the 70 weeks. And in chapters 10 through 12, that all pretty much goes together, chapters 10 through 12. And in some ways, those are the most complicated. The vision of the kings of the north and south. Those visions all, again, related somehow to chapter 7. There is another way that some people have divided the book, and that is chapter 2, starting in verse 4, actually I think midway through chapter 4, or verse 4, it's in Aramaic. instead of Hebrew. And it's Aramaic through chapter 7. In fact, in the Hebrew, in the original language, when you get to chapter 2, verse 4, it actually has a notation in the original language. It says Aramaic. So it's like, okay, we're switching to Aramaic now. It's the same alphabet, same, a lot of the similar vocabulary. And if you're just reading through it, it might not be obvious to you because Aramaic, it looks like Hebrew, but it actually says Aramaic. And it goes, it's Aramaic through chapter 7. And then chapter 8 again, it picks up into Hebrew. And so some people have divided it that way and said, well, chapter, it's through chapter 7, is the focus is on the nations, and that's why it's in Aramaic. And then chapter 8 through 12 is has to do with God's people, the Jews, and that's why it's back into Hebrew. And that may be, you know, that may be true, but I'll stick with this. Any questions before I move on and talk about chapter 7? Yes. Well, the theory is, I mean, we don't know. I mean, God doesn't say, this is why I wrote, this is why I had Daniel write in Aramaic. A lot of, I think the general consensus is that because it was kind of written to the whole world, not just to the Jewish people. In other words, if you read chapters 2 through 7, what is that? That's basically the history of God, God's dealings with Babylon. And it was written, if you will, you know, so that the nations would read it. It wasn't just written to the Jews, it was written. So Aramaic would have been something they would have all read, you know, the Babylonians. That's how, that's generally, I think, how people have understood it. Yeah. But like I said, we don't, you know, we don't know. I mean, God doesn't say this is the why, this is the reason. But this is the, by far, I mean, there's a little bit of Aramaic in Ezra. There's a verse or two in Jeremiah. But I mean, apart from the, I mean, this is, this section is one, it was really the only major section in the Old Testament written in Aramaic. But again, it's very similar to Hebrew. Same alphabet and so forth. I've never studied Aramaic, but any other questions about the whole book as a whole? Okay, so let me then just yes, Ed.
What is for chapter 6?
Yes.
The timeline, I don't see it 6. Where does that fit in there?
The very end.
Just to the right 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's a good question. Why isn't you know what? I think what happened is maybe because of the way Excel works, I think it's probably next to the 5, but it didn't get, I didn't do the, it's probably there, but I have to, yeah, thank you. What's that?
Your font color might be the same as the background.
No, no, I think what happened was, if you don't, it probably went beyond the cell and doesn't show up, and I probably have to go in and check that. Yeah, yeah, no, that was my fault. But thank you for bringing that out. It would be an engineer that would observe that I missed chapter 6. Yeah, no, thank you. I totally missed that, yeah.
I noticed that in the quote about the second deportation where Ezekiel is taken and so forth, is it fair to say the other contemporary prophets were basically in that Nebuchadnezzar operating in that time frame?
When you say the other prophets, you mean like Ezekiel and Jeremiah. So Jeremiah's reign, you know, I had a chart. It's not here, but I had a chart that actually shows their reigns in relation. So Jeremiah's, you remember Jeremiah was in Jerusalem when it fell. So if you see the bright yellow box there with the fall of Jerusalem, Jeremiah's ministry lasted a little bit beyond that. You remember he went down to Egypt with them after the fall of Jerusalem, and he was down there. So the main part of his ministry was the left side of this of that box and just a little bit beyond it. So as far as Ezekiel's ministry was pretty close to contemporary with Daniel, not as long. His ministry actually began when he was in Babylon. I'm not sure exactly specifically where it fits off the top of my head, the years, but it was pretty much contemporary with Daniel.
I know it's pure speculation, but do you think Ezekiel and Daniel maybe had lunch sometime?
Well, Ezekiel references Daniel, but yeah, you would think they probably knew each other. Yeah, I would think so, but we have no record of it. But yeah, but it, obviously, and we do know that Ezekiel refers to Daniel, and he was already known by that time in Ezekiel's day as a man of great wisdom and great faith and so forth. So, good question. So let me consider Daniel chapter 7, and I'm going to read Daniel chapter 7. And what I want to do is observe just at the beginning. I've divided Daniel 7 into two main parts. The outline here that you have is basically the first part. And the first part is the vision in verses 1 through 14. The second half from verse 15 through 28 is, you might say, the explanation or the interpretation of the vision. There's a lot of overlap. You know, in the second half, there's a lot of overlap with the first half, but there is some added detail. So let me just read. It's a lengthy chapter, but let me read it. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Now, again, if I can, you look at your little chart there with the green. First year of Belshazzar was 553 BC. That's when this vision took place. And visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove upon the great sea, and the four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue at the feet of it, and was diverse from all the beasts that were there or that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. I beheld till the thrones were cast down, and the Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was like the fiery flame, and his wheels as burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The judgment was set, and the books were opened. I beheld then because of the voice of the great words which the horn spoke. I beheld even till the beast was slain, and his body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As concerning the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for season and time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him, and there was given him dominion and glory and kingdom, that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. And now that's the description of the vision. Now verse 15 on is Daniel inquiring about that vision and then explanation given to him. So verse 15, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of things. Now here, verse 17 and 18 is critical to the chapter because this explains generally the point of the chapter. Verse 17, these great beasts which are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Now that's the point of the chapter. Okay, and again, that's, I would say, the central point of the book. Okay, now, verse 19, he especially inquires about the fourth beast. He says, then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured broken pieces and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the others which came up and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until times and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. Let me first of all point out here at the bottom of the page the themes of Daniel 7. Again, kind of obviously closely related to the themes we gave for the whole book. But I give you 3 things. First of all, it's a description of Gentile rule until the Messianic kingdom. What I mean by that is, okay, here's Daniel in Babylon. They are in captivity. Jerusalem has been destroyed. The temple has been destroyed. And the question is, when will the kingdom come? When will all these promises about the kingdom come? And basically, this is a description of what Jesus called the time of the Gentiles. This is the time when the Gentiles rule, and you might say specifically rule over Jerusalem, and are basically. In control, as it were. Yes?
Luke 17 or Luke 21?
I have to think of it. You know, this is the time that Jerusalem is given over to the Gentiles. It's the time until the Messiah actually comes and reigns on Jerusalem, and reigns in Jerusalem. You know, in other words, the Jews, there was no king. There has been no king in Jerusalem since that day, right? Since 586. It's parallel. This Gentile rule of is, and that's the point of chapter 7, verse 17 and 18, which we read. The parallel is Nebuchadnezzar's vision in chapter 2. And you remember that vision of the great image And this is important. Chapter 2 and chapter 7 are parallel. And that vision was years before. Okay, this is the first year of Belshazzar. The vision that Nebuchadnezzar had was all the way back in, 605 or so. 604, something like that. This is now 553. So almost 50 years between these two visions. The first one Nebuchadnezzar had, the second one Belshazzar or Daniel had. But remember, the vision that Nebuchadnezzar had was a huge, massive image of a man. It was impressive. It was shining, gold head, silver body, and it was at least initially like massive and impressive, right? But here you get four ferocious beasts, and it has been observed that, kind of like when you look at Daniel chapter 2 and you see that image, that's kind of like man's view, kind of like man's view of his own kingdom, if you will. very impressive. You know how man always makes monuments to himself, we, all the great men in our history, we make monuments, we make statues. I saw yesterday, I was watching something it was at the Lincoln Memorial, and there's Abraham Lincoln sitting on his chair looking very somber. And, we make statues of our great men and our great people, and it's like honoring what wonderful people we are and what great men we have. And that's kind of man's view of his, it's his image, it's his idolatry, right? But when you look at the beasts, it's like you might say it's God's view of man's kingdom. Ferocious and wicked, cruel, very cruel.
How would a Orthodox Jewish rabbi interpret what you just read as an overall understanding of that particular chapter today?
Well, I think an Orthodox is looking for, he's looking for this day. I mean, the Orthodox Jews are looking for the same thing that we're looking for. The only difference is we know that he came already the first time. They're looking for him to come and deliver the Jews at the end. And so, yeah, the Jews are, I would say the Orthodox are looking for the Messiah right now for the same reason we are looking for the second coming. Because if we see what's happening in the world, we see the, not just hatred for Christianity, but truly the hatred of the Jews, which is also satanic and which is a sign of the end. So I think they're looking for this. They're looking for their Messiah. And the irony is, who are they going to receive at least initially as their Messiah? The little horn. So it's interesting because, that's an interesting question. Yeah.
I don't want to sound stupid here, but I just got a click in my head when you mentioned talking about this chapter showing the Gentile kingdoms being the statue, which I've never gotten a picture of. So the statue, the gold head and,
yes,
all that down, is a picture of the beginning of men,
well,
the Gentiles, all the way to the end with the Jews not having a king anymore. It's like that statue's from that point to the point where,
correct,
Christ returns.
Correct. Correct.
I never got that.
It's the time of the Gentiles. And what's important also about the image, and I think this is critical, it's united. It's one image. Here you have the beast, individual beast, but you understand it's a united kingdom. There's a sense in which it's one. And you see that in the book of Revelation, right? Remember the beast, the dragon? Well, the sense in which the dragon is Satan. There's a sense in which the beast, the dragon or the beast is the kingdoms of the world, all of them. And there's a sense in which it's the Antichrist. It's kind of confusing, but it's there's a sense in which, this is all one thing and it's united. Okay, so that's an important aspect to this. But my point here, we have to, if you, again, to understand that you have to keep this in mind. These are clearly two the same basic concepts in chapter 2 and chapter 7. So remember, how does it end in chapter 2? Remember when he sees this huge image, the head is gold, and it's Nebuchadnezzar, it's Babylon, and then it's Medo-Persia, and then it's Greece, and then it's Rome, and then it divides into 10 toes. And then what happens? There's a rock that comes out of heaven, not cut with hands, destroys the whole image. That's why I say I'm a premillennialist. Has that happened yet? When Christ came the first time, is that what happened? Were all the kingdoms destroyed? No. I mean, it says at chapter 2, right? It says that the image becomes like chaff. It's completely shattered. It becomes like chaff and spread to the wind. And then the rock becomes what? A mountain that fills the whole earth. That's the kingdom. That hasn't happened yet. Okay? We still have, as far as I know, the kings of the world are pretty much still evil. You know, we're not seeing righteousness reign, right? So, but now, so when you come to chapter 7 and you see these four beasts and you see the devouring, you see the 10, I'm getting ahead of myself, but you see the 10 horns, they're parallel to the 10 toes. Now you have a new thing. One horn comes out of those 10. He's called the little horn, but he becomes a big horn and he becomes the Antichrist. It's the introduction to the Antichrist. You say, who is the Antichrist? He's the one who is the epitome of this Gentile rule. He will be the climax of it. And that's who the Messiah will destroy when he comes. And he will destroy the whole system. Now, so chapter 2 and chapter 7 are parallel. They're talking about the same thing. And that's important to understand. And as you go through chapter... I don't want to get ahead of myself. But this is... When... I'll get to that. All right. So again, Gentile rule until the messianic kingdom, the Messiah. It describes the Gentile kingdom between Babylon and the coming of the Messiah. It says, secondly here, the climax of Gentile rule at the time of Messiah's coming in glory. And that's where we looked at, again, which I just described, that really being, and this is where chapter 7, I think, is really important. It describes, for lack of a better way to say it, it describes the political situation of the world when the Messiah comes. This is, again, one of the reasons I'm a premillennialist. What he describes has never happened. And the proof of that is nobody agrees on how it happened. You know, when prophecy is fulfilled, we all know it. When prophecy is fulfilled, we all agree on it. And this situation of 10 kings, three of them being replaced by one, and that one taking over and all 10 giving them, we've never seen anything like that. There's nothing like that at the first coming. And people have tried to work it out. It doesn't work. I mean, it's obviously it's not happened. That's still future. It's describing what the world is going to be like, what the political situation is going to be like at the end, what we've come to call through Daniel, the Great Tribulation, that last week of his 70th week, right? Which is in chapter 9. But all that to say, the political situation is fundamentally this. Somehow, out of the Roman Empire, and I'll talk about that when we get to that, but out of that, what was the Roman Empire, or is the extension of the Roman Empire, will come 10 kings. And those 10 kings, there will be another one that will arise. He won't be one of the 10. He will come out of the 10. There'll be 10 kings, and one will come up that will replace three. And that one then will actually it says in the book of Revelation, those 10 will give their authority over to the beast, and he will be the Antichrist. In the New Testament, he's called Antichrist, man of sin. That one king will rule, and that rule is described in Revelation 13. That's the political situation when the Messiah comes and sets up his kingdom on the earth. Now that's what Daniel chapter 7 is describing. What is at the end? That's where it extends from chapter 2. So chapter 2 just had this general statement that this rock comes out of the heavens, and there's 10 toes reflective of the 10 kings. But that's all that's mentioned really. Here, chapter 7 really expands on that. And Daniel, as he's listening to this vision, or as he's reviewing this vision, his big question is, well, what about that last beast? And what about that horn? And the 10 horns, and that's what he's really asking about, and gets clarification on. And we're thankful, because God reveals a lot in chapter 7 about that last king. But he reveals more later on in the book. That's why it's important to understand chapter 7. All right. So this chapter actually introduces us to the Antichrist. First time. Now, arguably, we have types of Antichrist, you know, in the narrative before this and so forth, but we don't have any clear historical prophecy regarding the Antichrist until this point. This is like kind of a new thing in a sense. Now, again, we have types of Antichrist, and we have, you know, but we don't have a clear historical prophecy of this individual. This is clear in Daniel chapter 7. And then, as I pointed out early on here, the eternal kingdom of the Messiah. So again, this being the theme of chapter 7 is really the coming of the eternal kingdom. And in a sense, that's the main theme. You have these Gentile kingdoms, and they're going to rule until the Messiah comes. And by the way, here's what the political situation is going to look like when he comes, and now he comes. And chapter 7 describes, as we read there in the middle of the chapter, verses 9 through 14, an amazing description. We could spend weeks just walking through that description. That's an amazingly important passage. In fact, Jesus quoted that passage when he's before the high priest, or before the Sanhedrin, right? And he said, "You will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds." He's referring to this passage. And they took it as blasphemy, because he was claiming there to be the Messiah. And this is at his trial, right? But at any rate, this is an amazingly important passage. All right, I'm not getting very far here. Let me consider then the outline of Daniel 7. And again, the vision was verses 1 through 14. And I like to, let me just observe the broad outline of verses 1 through 14. In verses 1 and 2, you have the circumstances of the vision. And then in verse 2b down to verse 3, you have these, verses 2 through 8, you have the four beasts described. And then in verses 9 through 12, you have the coming of the Messianic kingdom. 9 through 14. That should say 14. So that basically, if I can say it this way, the division is divided into three parts here. The circumstances of the vision, the description of these four beasts, and then the coming of the Messianic kingdom. So let me just walk through it briefly probably spend a little more time down at the end of the vision. But first of all, in verse 1, it says, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon," again, that would have been 553 BC. That is when Belshazzar became co-regent with his father, Nabonidus. We talked a little bit about Belshazzar last fall, and how, again, historically, Belshazzar was kind of a stumbling block for a lot of people because we had no record of who a Belshazzar was. And we all knew, everybody knew from history that, you know, we all knew that the last king of the Neo-Babylonian Empire was Nabonidus. There was unified testimony to that in ancient records. And so finally we came across this record that basically said that Nabonidus had given authority, even as a king, to his son while he was off in Arabia. And we have the date, 553 BC. So Belshazzar was the son of Nabonidus. And it says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dreams and told the sum of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in my night vision, and behold. So this is the circumstances of the vision. It was the first year of Belshazzar. So again, this places it between chapters 4 and 5 somewhere. Chapter 4 was kind of the end of the end of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Chapter 5 is the end of Belshazzar's reign. So it was somewhere closer to chapter 5. So he wrote, we're thankful. He wrote, he had this dream, he had this vision upon his bed by night, and then he wrote it down. And so we're thankful that he wrote it down. He has this vision of four beasts, and verses 2 through 8 describes these four beasts. In verses 2 and 3, you have the nature of these beasts, and it's interesting to just observe. He says, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse from one another. And we could just say a couple things that describe all four of these beasts. We observe the extent of their reign. It speaks of the whole earth. It says the four winds of the heaven. It says, behold, the four winds of the heaven strove upon the great sea. What's the great sea? Humanity, the earth. I mean, you see this. I mean, we could go through texts that describe humanity. And really, you could really say, oftentimes, especially in the Psalms, humanity is described as a raging sea. Yeah, they're opposed. It's the rebellion of mankind against God. That's kind of the picture. And so this is over the whole earth, and the origin is from the earth. These kingdoms are from the earth. Not to get ahead of myself, but again, this is the distinction. Remember when Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world? He was not saying that the kingdom would not be in the world. That's not what he was saying at all. What he was saying is, my kingdom is not of the world. It's not from the world. It's not the rebellion of mankind. It's not from the seas of mankind. It's from heaven. Hence, the rock comes from heaven. You know, it's cut without hands. The point here is that these kingdoms are actually from the rebellious earth. That is their origin. That is who they're over. It speaks of four beasts, and it speaks of their magnitude, four great beasts. These are impressive. They're ferocious. And I think maybe one of the most interesting parts of this is this. It speaks of they are diverse, one from another. They are all related, and as I said in relation to chapter 2, they are, in a sense, all united. They're all rebellious. They're all from this world, but yet each of them is diverse. And as you go through those kingdoms, as you go through Babylon and Medo-Persia and Greece and Rome, they are all distinct. And as it has been pointed out, even in the, you go back to the image, you know, the head is gold, the breast is silver, and the loins are brass, and the legs and the feet are iron. And you know, it's interesting, and we talked about that last time, but those metals seem to especially relate to each of those kingdoms in their uniqueness. You know, there's a sense in which Babylon was especially known for its gold. It's gold temples. It's gold. You know, they were, Nebuchadnezzar was consumed with gold, and Babylon was consumed with gold. And Herodotus gives us testimony to that fact when he visited Babylon, not a century after Nebuchadnezzar. You know, so Medo-Persia was especially known for silver, and they were focused on silver, and the focus was on, as you read the text, gathering taxes. And you read about Medo-Persia, it was about silver. When you come to Greece was actually, they were known for their bronze armor. And they were known as a kingdom of bronze, of brass. And then Rome, of course, was the age of iron. And they were known as a kingdom that used iron. So it's just interesting. They were all distinct. These kingdoms were diverse in various ways. So, but especially the last one. The last one is especially diverse. And that's kind of an interesting one. Okay, so you come to verse 4 then, and it describes the first beast. And the first beast, we know, is speaking of Babylon, is speaking of Nebuchadnezzar. And it says, "The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it." Well, when you think of a lion, and you think of an eagle, I mean, that's the idea of wings. I mean, that's the sign of what? I mean, an eagle and a lion. Really, at the end of the day, the first thing that comes to my mind is majesty. I mean, who uses, I mean, you know, all the great kingdoms use a lion and an eagle to represent them. And why? Because lion suggests strength. Eagle suggests speed. Again, there's something, at the end of the day, there's something majestic about this creature. It is devouring. When you think of a lion and you think of an eagle, they devour, right? But there's something, you know, if you say, and it's kind of an interesting statement. I'm not sure I can explain why necessarily, but there seems to be this elevated view of Nebuchadnezzar in relation to the other kings. There was something majestic about his, whatever, about his kingdom. But clearly it has the idea of strength, speed, majesty. But there's this very interesting statement where it says, "It was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man. His wings were plucked. It was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man. A man's heart was given to it." I think it is referring to the change that took place in Nebuchadnezzar's heart back in chapter 4. It's interesting, the beast became like a man. I think it suggests, I'm not going to be dogmatic about this, but I'm inclined to say, as I said back when we looked at chapter 4, that this is, you know, a statement of the fact that Nebuchadnezzar was in fact regenerated. I rather suspect we'll see Nebuchadnezzar in heaven. I'm not going to be dogmatic about that, but when you read his testimony in chapter 4, it took him a while to get to that point, and the Lord utterly humbled Nebuchadnezzar for 7 years in the wilderness, eating grass like a cow. And at the end, what did he say? He acknowledged the Most High. And now I exalt him. And this is, I think, what it's referring to. And notice, he is changed from a beast into a man, right? I mean, an interesting picture. And what a statement, truly, of God's power. That he took the head of gold. This is the chief of the rebels against God. And he took him and he humbled him and actually saved him. That's an amazing statement. You know, he could have done that with Pharaoh in Egypt. But he didn't. You know, I don't know why. But God, for whatever reason, chose to save Nebuchadnezzar. So the lion with eagle's wings is Babylon. Again, it corresponds to the gold head in chapter 2. In verse 5, we have the second beast, which is a bear. And here, this is Media Persia. He says, "And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh." Well, when you think of a bear versus a lion, again, diverse from each other, what do they have in common? Well, they're both carnivores. They're both, yeah, you don't want to meet either one of them probably in the wild. take your pick, lion, bear, probably the end is going to be the same. But when you think of a bear, you think of something that's maybe a little more ferocious, but maybe not as agile. Certainly not as majestic. And when you think of a lion, you think of something that's impressive. You're the king of the jungle, you know. When you think of a bear, you think of something that's more just ferocious. Again, I don't think I'd want to meet either one, especially if they were hungry. But so they're both ferocious. They're both devouring. But the bear, it seems to be the picture here is something that's larger. And Media Persia was much larger than Babylon. Babylon, as the Neo-Babylonian kingdom in relation to the other kingdoms, was not as large. Media Persia was very large, massive. So this picture of a bear suggests size, strength, ferocity, again, ravaging, maybe not quite as agile, not as majestic. It says it was raised up itself on one side. And this, I think most commentators agree, this is a reflection of Persia's relation to Media. It was two kingdoms merged together under Cyrus, and Persia was more dominant than Media. I think Media was more dominant initially, but then Persia became more dominant. And Persia, and so you have this picture, and you have this same picture in chapter 8 regarding the Medo-Persian Empire. In chapter 8, verse 3, it says, "I lifted up my eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but the one was higher than the other." That's actually a description of Medo-Persia. One horn was bigger than the other horn, i.e. Persia was greater than Media. So that's kind of the picture here, that it's this combination. And then it speaks of three ribs in its mouth, something it had obviously devoured. And so, again, we don't know for sure, but it has been suggested that this is perhaps a reference to the three great kingdoms that Medo-Persia devoured, which were Lydia, Egypt, and Babylonia. That's who were all conquered. So you have the lion, the bear, and then you have, fourthly, in verse 6, the leopard with four wings and four heads. So in verse 6, it says, "And after this I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl, the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it." Well, again, when you think of a leopard, like a lion, like a bear, you wouldn't want to meet it. It also is ferocious. It will also kill you. It will also devour you. But when you think of a leopard, you think of something extremely fast. And when it says a leopard with four wings, now you're thinking about something like super fast. Okay, so that's the picture. And of course, that is, that's obviously a fit description for Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great swept over the Medo-Persian Empire. I mean, he just devoured it quickly. I mean, he was, 33 when he died? He had conquered the world. Alexander the Great is one of the most amazing figures in history, just from the standpoint of militarily. I mean, he was a masterful military leader. I don't think he ever lost a battle, did he? Just incredible. You can't even comprehend what he did, right? So extreme speed is the idea. And by the way, that's also related to us in chapter 8, verse 5. It says, this is also referring to the same kingdom. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat, that's Alexander the Great, came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. He didn't even touch the ground. I mean, the picture is, you know, just extreme speed. Totally destroyed Media Persia, right? And took over the whole known world. It says a leopard with four wings and four heads, and it is, I think, also generally conceded that the four heads refer to the division of the empire that took place when Alexander died. And it was initially divided between four generals. It's not as simple. I mean, it was a kind of a complicated dynamic to how all that went down. But at the end of the day, it was divided four ways. The most important ones were Ptolemy in Egypt and the Seleucids in Assyria and much of chapter 11 and 12, or chapter 11, deal with those events. And we'll look at that. But this is speaking of the division. Again, notice the amazing Daniel, really, its prophecies are amazingly precise. Which I go back to this, it's the reason critics have tried so hard to destroy the book of Daniel. The book of Daniel has been the brunt of some of the most severe criticism of liberals and people who hate the Bible because its prophecies are so precise. Think about this. This was all prophesied, you know, before any of this happened. I mean, in Daniel's lifetime, we saw Babylon, and at the very end of his life, we saw Cyrus and Media Persia. But none of this other stuff ever had happened before he died. And then the most interesting one, and here we'll spend a little bit of time, the most interesting one is verses 7 and 8. We have this fourth beast, the beast with iron teeth and 10 horns. Let me read it. Wow, what an interesting description. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet of it. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man and a mouth speaking great things. Now, the first thing that I would just point out about this beast in a broad way is, and I'll say more about it later, but I think the most obvious thing as you come to this is it is completely different from the other three beasts. I mean, the other three beasts were different among themselves, but this one is completely different from all of them. And when it speaks, for example, of iron teeth, and it speaks of 10 horns. I mean, do you know of any beast like that? I mean, there's not. It's so completely different. It's almost, the picture is something almost grotesque. Like something, you know, out of a horror film or something. I mean, it's almost, you get the impression it's like something like out of this world. It's like not even natural. It's so different from the others. And that, I think, is meant to be the picture. And maybe the most important thing in regard to how it's different is its nature. Its nature, described in the beginning, verse 7, it describes in verse 7 first its nature and then its work. But its nature is this. It is extremely dreadful. The words that are used in the King James here in verse 7 are dreadful, terrible, strong exceedingly, and having great iron teeth. The idea is something that even beyond a lion or bear or a leopard, almost unimaginable terror produced by this beast. The idea in the first word of dread, dreadful, is the Aramaic word that really relates to fear. And it really has the idea of creating amazing fear. I have some other references where this word is used in the book of Daniel. Again, it's an Aramaic word. In chapter 2, verse 31, it says, "Thou, O King Saul, behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible." That's actually the same word as dreadful in the King James in the chapter 7, verse 7. It was, you know, this image, the whole image was dreadful. In chapter 4, verse 5, it says, "I saw a dream," this is Nebuchadnezzar, "which made me afraid. And the thoughts of my bed and the visions of my head troubled me." Same word. In chapter 5, verse 19, "And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him." Same word. Feared. The idea here is something that creates great dread, great fear. The word terrible is kind of a synonym. Again, the idea of something amazingly terrifying. It says it's strong exceedingly, not just kind of strong, but truly exceedingly strong, beyond all these other beasts, beyond what any of them had done. And then when it says great iron teeth, of course, teeth are what are used for devouring, and anything that has great teeth is impressive and ferocious. We watched the other night, they had this little thing, we were over at Julia's, and we watched this little thing, 10 of the most ferocious sea creatures. And, you know, they all had big teeth, you know. So, you know, of course, the last one, of course, was predictably the great white shark. And they show its teeth. And the teeth, obviously, a statement of their ability to devour, their ability to kill, their ability to destroy and consume. And so this one has great iron teeth. And iron teeth are especially impressive because, you know, when you think of iron teeth, you think of something that's not going anywhere. I mean, they are irresistible. They are enduring, strong. They don't, they're not going to rot. They're not going to fall out. I mean, the idea here is durability, certainly, as well as strength. And so as you look at its nature in verse 7, the idea of this kingdom is exceedingly powerful, destructive, terror-inspiring, irresistible, and enduring. All of those ideas are there. And in this sense, it is way beyond the other kingdoms. And by the way, this is describing Rome. Yes?
I was just looking at the other three kingdoms, and apparently Daniel has no way of saying it's like something.
Well, yeah, that's, yeah, it's not like... No, yeah, yeah, that's my point. It's kind of like it's totally unnatural. It's like a freak. It's almost like something that, you know, you're right. It's not, he doesn't say another animal. It's like there's nothing to describe it. What actually, forgive me, I'm a man of my age. What came to my mind was transhumanism. It's like something totally, you know, otherworldly. I mean, that's kind of the picture. What's that? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, that's a good way to say it. I mean, it's like something you'd see in a horror movie. You know, you think of something, this creature with iron teeth and 10 horns, you think, that's grotesque. That's ugly. That's sick. And that's kind of the picture of this last kingdom. Now, again, let me just say before I go on, I think this is it's obviously referring to Rome, but I want to suggest to you, everybody focuses, you know, on the Rome of the time, you know, of the Roman Empire. But the real focus of this passage is the Rome at the end of the age. That's what this is really describing. That's the kingdom. That's the expression that's coming. It's going to be the most grotesque, wicked, irresistible, overwhelming system that has ever come on the face of the earth. It's describing Revelation 13. Rome, back in the days of, you know, Christ and the days of the Roman Empire, were the roots of this thing. But it's not the final manifestation of it. He's describing here the final manifestation of it. It's going to be irresistible. It's going to be devouring to a degree that no kingdom in the history of the world, not even Nazi Germany, nothing will come close to what is going to come in that last day before Christ comes in the tribulation. And this is described in the book of Revelation. And I think this is where you look at now, you look at its work in verse 7, in the second half of verse 7. Here's what it does. Okay, first half was its nature. Now notice what it does. It devoured, it broke in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, I just want you to observe several things about its work. First of all, it devoured. Now, all of these other beasts devoured, but this one devours to a whole new level. And he says it devoured, and it devoured by its great iron teeth. Again, suggests a kind of irresistibility and a strength that the world has never seen in a kingdom. It consumes the people of the world, and I would argue that the consumption also, and I was thinking about this actually this morning when I was getting ready, I was thinking, you know, is the focus on just the consuming of the world, or is it on actually the consuming of God's people? Because they really, these kingdoms, I mean, what does the beast do at the end? I mean, he hates the saint, and the saints especially, the Jews, right, in the tribulation. He's going to devour God's people. You know, this is the picture in Daniel or in Revelation 7, right? You know, Mark, you look like you want to say something.
You say irresistible. You use that in the sense that by will.
But I just man is
by the, choice, not by
man will not resist. Man can't, won't be able to resist it. It will. It's a little bit like, again, you think of. No, I would say they can't. There will be no successful rebellion against it. It will be irresistible. I think of, again, a picture of it, I think a certain degree you could see in something like a Nazi Germany. But that was before we had the technology. I mean, you imagine what Hitler would have done if he had the technology we have today? You see, there's no hiding. There's just no hiding. There is no way to resist. I don't think we realize how far technology has come in relation to controlling of people. And there is no hiding. There's no resisting. There just isn't.
Isn't it kind of clear in the end where you've got the mark that you can't buy and sell, right?
Correct.
That if you take that mark, you're done. It's over. If you don't take the mark, you're dead.
Correct.
It's a complete division.
Correct.
And it's like the whole goal is to wipe any resistance off the face of the earth.
Correct.
All gone. Everybody follows.
Correct. It's Revelation 14. That's what I'm saying. This description, you can go to Revelation 13 and that's what it's describing. A lot of people take this passage and to try to describe Rome in the days of the Roman Empire. Well, that was just the beginning of this thing. And yeah, there is application of this to that. But that is not ultimately what it's describing. It's describing this last system that is going to be completely controlled. It's going to utterly control the whole earth in a way that has never been done. And it's going to be grotesque. It's going to be utterly irresistible. It's going to be sick. And it's going to be unlike anything that's ever been done. So that's the picture. So he says he break in pieces. The idea here is the word oftentimes shattered. The idea is shattered. It's actually the same word that's used of what Christ does to the nations when he comes. When he comes, he shatters the nations. In chapter 2, when the, again, I pointed out, you know, when the rock comes without, you know, cut without hands and smashes the image, and the image is shattered into millions of pieces and flies away like the chaff, right? That's the idea. That's the picture. It's what Jesus, you know, it's the same picture of Psalm 2 when he says he will shatter the kingdoms, right, with like a vessel. What does it say? He will shatter in pieces the kingdoms when he comes, right? Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah, with a rod of iron. Thank you. That's the picture. Complete disintegration. I mean, it's talking about complete destruction. In a way that was never done. And when you think of break in pieces, you think of utterly dividing, right? No unity. This is going to break down all, the system is going to break down all the things that have united different kinds of mankind. It's going to break it all down into pieces. And then it says, I love this, stamped the residue with the feet of it. So whatever it didn't actually devour, it completely stamped. We're talking about a ferocious, monstrous beast that is full of hatred and simply, you know, utterly destroys and devours. A picture of complete destruction. What it did not eat, it shattered and trampled. And this surely is a picture of the Antichrist kingdom. Look for a minute at Revelation 13. This is a description of Antichrist. And I'm just going to read it, and I'll just say a few words. And maybe we'll look at it more later. But it says, I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his horn 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard. His feet were as the feet of a bear. His mouth as the mouth of a lion. The dragon gave him his power, that's Satan, and his seat and great authority. So you can see this beast is the extension of all the kingdoms of the world that were mentioned back in Daniel, right? They're all there. Verse 3, and I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death. This is the Antichrist. This is the little horn. And it appears that he is raised from the dead. I don't know if he actually will be, but he will at least convince the world that he was raised from the dead, it seems. His deadly wound was healed. Notice, it's almost like an imitation of the resurrection of Christ. And the idea seems to be that this little horn is going to impress the world that he has finally succeeded in finding the secret to life. I saw one of his, verse 4, and they worshipped the dragon, which gave power. That's Satan. They're going to openly worship Satan. Gave power to the beast, that's the Antichrist, and they worshiped the beast, it's the Antichrist, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Notice, why do they worship him? Because of his great power. He has iron teeth. He is irresistible. He has broken everything in pieces. Verse 5, there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months, that's 3.5 years, He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. This is the amazing wickedness of this man, right? And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him. So when it says break in pieces, I'm inclined to think, you say, what is it that unites man, you know, areas of man? You say, well, family, it's kindreds, you know, languages and nations. Well, he's going to break all that down.
break all the barriers, break it all down into one, and, you know, onto little pieces, right? All that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain for the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. Then he goes down. I won't read the whole thing here, but he says, and this is what Tom was referring to, in verse 16, he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. His mark will be on every human being. I mean, this is nothing like anything Nebuchadnezzar ever dreamed of. This is nothing like Alexander the Great ever thought of. This will be a complete control, a complete rule. As complete as this will be the apex of man's rebellion against God. And I just need to close up here, but if you look at the next page, I just want to observe its diversity, which I already kind of mentioned, but I just want to kind of summarize it. It was diverse from all the beasts that were before it in this way, in these ways at least, and I you could probably think of some more. It is more ferocious than the other beasts. It is more enduring than the other beasts. It is more grotesque than the other beasts. It is utterly inhumane. It is utterly disgusting. And I will say, listen, where man has his way, it always becomes ugly. It just becomes full of death and destruction and hatred and wickedness. And that is where we're headed. I mean, that's the last kingdom. It will be utterly grotesque. Its form is diverse from the others, and I think this is also important. It's not like the others were monarchies. They were kings. This is something totally different. This is something which I think is reflected in the 10 toes. Remember the 10 toes back in the image? They were made of what? Clay mixed with iron. I think that makes a statement of, you know, what was Rome known for, first of all? It was a republic before, you know, Caesar took over, right? But and what happened, I need to close up here, but we'll talk about this maybe next time. But if you go back, this is where I'm thinking through this. You know, so much of this you say, you know, it doesn't, there is a sense in which all of Western civilization, since the fall of Rome, is an extension of that empire. In other words, it's one empire. And it broke down into nation states in Europe, right? That's all reflection. And I would say even the United States is in many respects the ultimate expression of this empire. And in fact, it's hard not to see somehow the U.S. as the ultimate expression of Babylon. I mean, it's just hard not to see that. I mean, we are, in a sense, the extension of this. But there are going to be 10 kings that come out of this, right? But all that to say, it's totally different in every way from all the other, from the other beasts. It's a completely different animal. And it's totally, so I'm constantly thinking, okay, how, it doesn't suggest that there's, the suggestion of the vision or the teaching of the vision is that that beast, Rome, that system, that government is somehow still over the whole earth. And it's breaking it down. And, so that's an interesting thing to think about. It had 10 horns referring to the 10 kings at the end of the age, which I said. Now, we'll talk a little bit more about the little horn next time. You can see the chart there that I have, which is just a really simple way of showing the parallel between Daniel 2, Daniel 7, and gives you the kingdoms and their dates. It's just kind of like a nice way to... But I want to, next time, we'll talk a little bit about the little horn, And then we'll go into the Messianic kingdom. And what is really, and this is what I want you to think about. When you come, I don't want to steal my thunder, but when you come to chapter 7, verse 9, and you see the Ancient of Days sitting on his throne, it is like this ultimate contrast between this perfect, all-wise, intelligent, rational king who is the king over the whole earth, and you come into his throne room. It's like the ultimate contrast between these grotesque beasts that are cruel, devouring, wicked, strange, and there you have this perfect ruler, God, who is king, and he will bring an end to this wicked rule. It's such a beautiful picture. And that's why I say, in many respects, this is the center of the book. This is where we're going. The Ancient of Days is still sitting. He's still sitting on the throne. And he is going to bring an end to all this chaos. He's going to judge. And he's going to deliver his people. And that really is the theme of the book. God is good. God is great. God is glorious. And the kingdoms of this world, they're going to be destroyed. Amen and amen. So listen, when you look out there and you see all these wicked men ruling our world, don't get upset. Don't get angry. And don't waste your time watching the news. It just makes you upset. Don't get upset. Listen, the Lord's in charge. The Lord is going to bring his kingdom. And all we need to do is keep our eyes on him, obey him, walk with him. And he'll take care of the big picture because he's in charge. So, all right, let's pray. Father, we thank you for this truth. You are the true and the living God, and you are sovereign over all the nations. You're sovereign over what has happened. You are sovereign over what's going to happen. You have told us from the beginning what the end will be. We're thankful that you are in charge. We're thankful that you are good and gracious and merciful, and you always help those who call upon you and humble themselves before you. We're thankful that you are a God who truly is gracious and who is merciful. But we're also thankful that you are a God who judges wickedness and indeed will destroy the wicked. We're thankful that you are the perfect ruler. And we pray that you would help us day by day to trust you, to rest in you, not to be discouraged, not to be fearful or anxious, but Lord, may our eyes be upon you, the Ancient of Days. We pray that you would fill us with faith, and may you fill us with your word, and may you rule in our hearts. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.